more people here today, or?
Maybe one more, but.
Oh, okay.
It's gotten empty. So.
That's not good. Ah. This is the best part. Yeah, I guess. Too bad. Okay. So yeah, first of all, Mark is sick today, fortunately. Also, sorry in advance for the lecture. I basically had a couple of hours to prepare. So today we will talk about gauge theories. So the entire motivation behind gauge theories, as you might remember, like the Lagrangians we have looked at so far. So for instance, the fermion Lagrangian, which looks like this. And for instance, the scalar field Lagrangian, which looks like C plus 1/2 m² minus phi. First of all, are you familiar with the Feynman's Lush notation? Yeah, great. All of these sort of have a set of symmetries that we can imply. So all of them, depending on what sort of structure we put on this, if we introduce the transformation like phi goes to some basically some symmetry group u multiplied with psi, or if you do psi bar goes to psi bar and this, this transformation here leaves this Lagrangian here invariant. Similarly, if you do phi goes to u phi and phi dagger goes to phi dagger u dagger, leaves the scalar Lagrangian invariant. But this only holds, of course, for global transformations u. So it's basically that u is the same for every space-time point. And that's sort of all fine. One thing to note here is I've generally just skipped the matrix notation. So what happens here is in the normal case, or if we don't add any more structure, then this has to be a scalar. So for instance, the U1 symmetry transformation is U is equal to e to the I and then some angle theta, because this U here needs to be a unitary matrix for this to work. Okay, but we can also do other group transformations, in which case we need to introduce a bit more structure to it. So generally, throughout this entire thing, it is implied that if we introduce a gauge transformation, a global symmetry transformation, I guess you could call it, of dimension some d, I guess, then all of the psi's turn into vectors of dimension d, and all of the u's are d times d matrices. So that basically, you know, this transformation is psi I goes to u I j psi j, right? So it's all just implied. The question now is, how can we modify the Lagrangians we have here to make it invariant also under a local transformation? And by a local transformation, you basically mean that all of the matrices that you multiply these with depend on the space-time position. We immediately see that if we have a local transformation, then this Lagrangian isn't invariant anymore, because this object here do not simply commute with the derivative operator, right? So what we want to do is that we change, or as a first sort of way to try to approximate this, is that we change the derivative operator and basically replace it with what we call the conjugate derivative, which we say is equal to the normal derivative plus some additional object k, whatever that might be. Just looking for the structure, it is immediately obvious that k must be a matrix of dimension basically the same as this. So if this is an n times n matrix, then this needs to be an n times n matrix. Or it can be a scalar, but that doesn't really do anything for us. as we will see. So that means that the object, if we then at the moment just look at this for now, then we want this to transform. So we want this to transform in sort of the expected manner of, in this way here, under a local transformation. That's sort of the requirement we put on this, new derivative operator. And basically that means that if we look at this, if we say that, if we just by notation say that d goes to d mu star, that's probably a horrible way to write it. Let's do tilde, because it's not a complex conjugate. And we know how phi transforms. This basically means that, so that means that d mu tilde must times u must be equal to u times d mu. From this, it's immediately obvious that d mu tilde basically transform as u d mu u dagger by multiplying by its adjoint, its Hermitian on both sides. This, again, if we then basically plug in this expression here into here, we see that k basically transform as uk u dagger minus d mu u u dagger. Okay, we can very easily just see what that implies in the standard u1 case. In this case, these things commute, so k goes to k plus some additional quantity, and if we say that u is equal to e to the I phi x, then this quantity here is just equal to minus, no, the minus is here, so I d mu phi, as you are used to, I guess. Anyway, it's quite normal to, so we want k, what do we want from k? It's quite normal, rather than to write k, to basically expand it in a set of standardized matrices. So this is normally taken to be the generators of the symmetry group U. So you basically, it's quite normal to write k equal to minus I g times a mu a t a here. And then t a is then the generators of the symmetry group U, which is generally written that u is equal to e to the I g a. Well, we don't need the same a's, so let's call them phi. Phi I t a. So that's basically the generalization away from abelian gauge theories as we have in QED. A couple of interesting things to talk about. This is an element of a Lie group, generally. So that means that these generators here follow a couple of interesting have a couple of interesting properties. First of all, you normally choose these generators in such a way so that the trace of the multiplication of two generators is equal to 1/2 delta AB. That's a normal choice. And secondly, TA have what you call the structure constants, which is basically the commutator between two generators is proportional to another element of the generators. And this proportionality factor, these are then the structure constants. Okay, so since we have basically introduced this derivative in the way so that we have the local symmetry transformation that we want, then that basically means that if we replace all the derivatives by this other derivative, we get back something that is once again invariant under local transformations using matrices in whatever group we want. So basically, that's what we call the minimal substitution. So the minimal substitution is basically that you send D to D. So for the Dirac Lagrangian, that means that we get not vector psi bar I and then D slash minus M psi. And for the scalar field, we get 1 half d mu phi, no, d mu phi. And these two Lagrangians, we have now created them so that they are invariant under this transformation here. But one thing to note is that in doing so, since we have introduced this additional part here to the derivative, what we called k, which we later expanded in terms of the generators, then first of all, we know that k must obviously be space-time dependent because it transforms in sort of a space-time dependent way. And basically these components here that we have introduced are now what we call our gauge fields. So they are additional fields with the expected number of degrees of freedom, I guess. So one of the next questions will be, okay, so we have now introduced a way that these gauge fields couple to our normal fields, like our matter fields, fermion fields, and scalar fields. But the question is, how do we then introduce kinematics for these gauge fields that we've introduced so that you know they can propagate and so on and so forth, because at the moment they are just static objects that interact at sort of a local position. First of all, a quick note here. This is what you call the minimal coupling. So this is sort of the smallest gauge invariant way of introducing a coupling between the fields you have and this gauge field. But there are, of course, higher order couplings that you can introduce that are also gauge invariant and Lorentz invariant and whatever you require of L. So one possibility in that case is, let's see, I wrote it down somewhere. Oh, I don't need it. Is for instance, to the fermions, you can couple it to the gauge fields in this way. So this is one possible term in our Lagrangian. The reason we avoid this is that to get this into the Lagrangian, you need to add some sort of coupling constant in front. The quick reasoning for this is, of course, that every term in the Lagrangian needs to have a given dimension. So the dimension of the Lagrangian is mass fourth, which means that every term given is mass fourth and mass to the power fourth. And if we check the dimension of this term here, we very quickly see that it is 5. Meaning that this coupling constant that you add here, it's first of all, it's you know it's a coupling constant. It's sort of a way to measure the strength of the coupling you're talking about, but it's also needed to make it the right dimension. But that means that this coupling constant has a mass or a negative mass dimension, which means that that makes the theory non-renormalizable, which is the reason we exclude it in this case. Have you talked about renormalizability? We will come to it later, but generally the idea behind the idea behind this simple argument to renormalizability, there are other theories that have dimensionful or positive dimension couplings and so on and so forth that are still not renormalizable. But this argument is actually quite easy. It's basically if you assume that this is a small quantity, right, and you want to do any form of perturbation theory, then you will get terms in whatever you calculate that is, you know, one is to the power a, and the second one is a squared, and the third one is a cubed, and so on and so forth, right? But whatever quantity you are calculating needs to be, you know, it has a given dimension. And since you increase the number of a's, that means that you, you know, increase the negative mass dimension. So you need to cancel this dimension with something else. And generally, the only sort of dimensionful quantity you can pick from is what you call the renormalization scale, which is sort of the uppercut of what we, how far we expect our theory to be, you know, defined in momentum space. And the way renormalization works is, of course, you don't want any physical quantities to be dependent on your renormalization scale in the end. But the problem is, if we do perturbation theory with these couplings, then you need to basically add like a lambda here, and a lambda squared here, and a lambda cubed here, which basically means that there is no way to get the renormalization scale out of your theory. And thus the theory is not renormalizable. Anyway, so that's one additional possible coupling. If you go through just the calculation with this coupling, you will see that it sort of looks like a coupling to, or it's a coupling between fermions and like magnetic dipole, I think, is basically what this coupling is. So it's also not very fundamental in that sense. Anyway, so the next sort of task we have ahead of us is that we want to create an object in our Lagrangian that can describe the propagation of the gauge fields we introduce. And the question, so the biggest problem then is that, okay, so the requirements we have in our Lagrangian is that there are a couple of invariances we want, but we want it specifically to be gauge invariant, because that's basically the symmetry we're introducing, and we want it to be Lorentz invariant. So we need to find some sort of object that has these properties that also describe dynamics of the A fields. There are many ways to sort of go about doing this. Probably my favorite approach is to know that, okay, we have already seen that these covariant derivatives transform in this way here, right? So that means that if you, of course, this is not how we will end up in the end. But if you take something that looks like this, then this here is a gauge invariant quantity. Of course, it's not very well defined because it has open derivatives that you need to use on something. But this is gauge invariant because basically this transforms to d mu u dagger u d mu u dagger u. And then if you trace this, then you know this is one, and this goes around with cyclic permutation and cancel this, and therefore it is gauge invariant. So that doesn't work. What we can look at is, okay, so what if we add another d? If we write this quantity, this transforms exactly in the same way as this field. Well, it's quite obvious, actually. It's basically the same. These here in the middle cancel, and then you get the outer edges again. So this is all fine. But what if we then calculate the commutator between d mu and d nu? This object here will also, of course, transform like this. But if you carry out this commutator, well, it's quite straightforward, actually. You insert the expression we have up there for the commutator, and what you end up with is, so throughout this lecture, I guess we will use the standard notation. There is a 1/4 probability that I get the signs on the ice correct, which probably isn't the case here. But anyway, minus d nu a mu, and then you get an additional term that is, let's see. Okay, this is either plus or minus. I am not. Okay, I think it's minus. A mu. A mu. Right. Okay. Yes.
Why the first? I didn't understand why the first approach doesn't work. Maybe we can slightly permutate the U dagger to the left, but then we see it is gauge invariant.
Yeah, as I said, this thing is gauge invariant. That's sort of where we start. The problem is, you know, this thing is somehow equal or proportional to this, right? And that's an open derivative. So the only way you can do anything with this is to insert something that the derivative works on. So this is just a motivation for why we go this way. But the interesting thing is now that we have calculated this commutator, we see that it has no open derivatives. It is like a purely geometric object, which makes it like a perfect candidate for our field string tensor. So this probably seems, you know, known to you. I'm sure you've seen this electromagnetic field strength tensor before. So this is the electromagnetic field strength tensor here. But then we have an additional term that's basically the commutator between our fields here. And this is then zero in the electromagnetic theory because all quantities commute in that case, right? Okay. So we basically define this to be equal to F mu nu, right? And then simply, well, the final requirement, of course, is that we want Lorentz invariant, so we need to contract this thing with itself. So we basically follow the prescription we did here, meaning that the Young-Mills Lagrangian, it has a vector 1 over 4 for normalization reasons. And then it's f mu nu. And then the trace is then, of course, the trace over these indices here in whatever gauge group we're working for. Yeah. OK, so that is all fine. One thing that's actually quite interesting, the question now is, We want to study the transformation properties of this K a bit further, I guess. So we have seen how K transforms. It's given by the equation up there. So the question is basically how does that mean that these A's transform? Because we are more interested in the A's than we are in the K's. They are technically in the same quantity, but in one case, we have, you know, a field with indices, and in the other case, we have a matrix, because in this notation, the A's have been taken out of the matrix notation. So how do we do this? Yeah. So the easiest way to do this is because U is sort of an element of some Lie group, it's possible to write it on exponential. Well, we've already done this, I think. Yeah, we wrote it up here, right? So if we then take an infinite, well, that's actually sort of how the Lie algebras are defined. They have some sort of closeness relations so that you can sort of say something about a transformation that's, or a group element that's slightly far away by its properties. Like, for instance, if you have a group element in some weird space and you know what it is at a point, and you want to know what it is in a point close by, then you can basically say something about this using the properties of this. That's sort of the entire idea behind Lie groups. So it has some sort of closeness relation. So that means that it's sort of valid to try to see what happens if we do like a very small Lie transformation, right? So we can then expand this U here in the smallness of phi. G phi, and phi is still a variable of x, just to remind you of that, times this, and then, of course, plus order phi squared, right? We can then apply this transformation to we can apply this transformation to A, or to K, or whatever you want to call it. And basically doing so, we see that A has to transform as a mu a plus 1 over d d mu phi a plus the structure constant bc b phi c c and then plus order phi squared. Right. So this is the transformation of A during a small transformation of phi. And one sort of very interesting thing you see here is that you see that the transformation of A, the transformation of index of A is completely independent of the representation of the group that we're talking about. We didn't really talk much about representations. Do you know a lot about representations? Know what they are, basically, right? Okay, so a representation is, so for instance, if we look at the symmetry group SU2, right? It's all, okay, let's not phrase it in that way. SU2 is what you call completely defined by its algebra. So the whole idea behind SU2 is that if you take two elements of SU2, TA and TB, then that is equal to I, and then the Levi-Civita tensor ABC TC, right? That is sort of the definition of SU2. And the thing is, there are many matrices you can create that does this, right? So the standard representation, what we call the fundamental representation, will be the lowest dimension representation, or the lowest dimension of matrices you can create that satisfy this relation here, right? So for SU2, these are the polar matrices. But you can also go one step up and create a higher order representation. So for instance, you can create the next ordered representation of SU2, which is 1, 0, minus 1, 1 three-dimensional that looks like that. And then it's like 1, minus 1, minus 1, 1, I think. And then it's 1 that's like I. This might be completely wrong, so I'm sorry about that. But it looks something like that. And you basically have talked about higher order representations when you talked about like addition of angular momentum in quantum mechanics.
But isn't also the point that you can have even for one dimension, like for a fixed dimension, like for the polar matrices, you can also have different representations, like for the SU2 and 2 × 2 matrices, they are not, itself, a matter of how you choose your basis, right?
Yeah, you can of course do a similarity transformation between representations, but they are not, you would say that they are the same representation, basically, if you choose your matrix is slightly different. So basically, if you can find a vector S, so that S in R1 is equal to this in R2, then you say that the representations are identical. Right. Okay. So from addition of angular momentum, I don't know if you just ignore this part here, you see that these are the possible eigenvalues of the addition of two angular momentums. So that spin half plus spin half gives you either spin one, spin zero, spin minus one. But anyway, so that's the whole idea of representations. So this thing here can, even though you specify that the symmetry group is SU2, then the matrices you deal with can be higher order representations of SU2 so that they can be, three-dimensional, four-dimensional, so on and so forth, okay? But the interesting thing here, what I was going to say, is basically that the transformation of the gauge field is completely independent of the representation you're dealing with. Because you see that you have basically no reference to the representation here. The only thing you reference is what you call the gate or the group algebra, which is completely defined by the structure constants. And they are, they are per definition sort of the group, so they don't change with representations. That's basically how you create higher order representations. Okay. One thing you can see from this, it's sort of straightforward. If you then do, say, a Okay, so what do you know about the adjoint representation? So the adjoint representation basically has structure constants A, which are equal to, structure constants A, and then let's call them ij, like the matrix indices, are equal to F aij. That is the adjoint representation of your group. And you see from this that actually under a global transformation of the group U of the gauge field A, this transforms under the adjoint representation. You need to fiddle a bit with this and re-exponentiate it, but basically what you get is that under a global transformation, this goes to U A B adjoint A B mu, right? So that's just an interesting, I guess, tidbit about. It's actually quite important, but yeah. Okay, so let's get back to talking about the field tensors. So we wrote down the field strength tensor up there with this expression, and we can just make one quick observation that F mu nu is equal to, if we basically take out the the generators from the object A, we see that this is equal to d mu A and nu A T A minus D mu A mu A T A plus, no, it's mine, minus I G, it's basically T, no, it's not T, let's do A, A mu B mu T A TB, right? And this, as we've seen earlier, is equal to this, is equal to the structure constant. So this is equal to d mu, a t a minus d mu, a t a. And then it is, sine unknown is equal to f. Let's see. A B C A mu A B mu T C. Okay, right?
I think the sign is correct.
Yeah, I think so as well. Because there comes some minus from here.
There's a minus I and there comes an A from the constant.
Exactly. Okay, so if you look at this, you will also see that actually the field strength tensors are also just proportional to the generators. So basically you can write F mu nu as equal to F mu nu A T A, right? Where F mu nu, I'm repeating myself, but anyway, this is equal to D mu A nu A minus D nu A mu A plus G F A B C A B mu A mu B. No, C. This switch here basically comes from the fact that these are supposed to be totally anti-symmetric. But yeah. So that's that. So that means that the Young-Mills Lagrangian we wrote down a bit earlier, which is equal to 1/2. Did I write 1/2 or 1/4? Okay, it's supposed to be 1/2. Sorry.
Are you sure?
Yes. You'll see in a second. Okay. Yeah, you get an additional from this trace, actually. That's the reason. Ta, then mu, nu, b, tb. So it looks like this.
Not the minus sign.
No, with the minus sign. And so we can pull these out of the traces, because the traces is basically all of the group indices are left in these generators here. And we know that the trace over, we saw earlier that trace TA TB is equal to 1/2 delta AB, right? So that gives you 1 minus 1/4 F mu nu A. These indices should be up. Sorry. B. Okay, right? Yes. So that is the Young-Mills-Lagrange. One thing you might ask yourself is, once again, are there any other, you know, gauge invariant, Lorentz invariant quantities we can create using the fields A or the field strength tensors? And the question to that is yes, sure. So one possible term you can create for the Lagrangian looks like this. Where F is what you call the dual field strength tensor. So the dual field strength tensor is basically defined as mu nu is equal to Levi-Civita mu alpha beta, right? But the problem with this quantity here is that since the Levi-Civita symbol is, what is it? Is an anti-symmetric tensor. That basically means that this full quantity here, when contracted, is a pseudoscalar, which means that including it into our theory breaks PT symmetry, and we want PT symmetry. One way to sort of remedy that, there are ways to remedy that. One way to fix that is that you can basically couple it to an additional field that is also pseudoscalar, because pseudoscalar times pseudoscalar gives you a scalar. And there are, well, it's basically the argument for why we don't include this into our theory is the same as the previous, that if we then have a coupling constant in front, then this needs to have negative mass dimension again. You actually use this expression here. You might come over it later. It is actually one of the best ways to describe how the neutral pion interacts with the electromagnetic fields. And the effect it creates, it actually explicitly breaks a subsymmetry of U1 called the axial symmetry, which is what you call the axial anomaly. This construct here is also used when describing instantons, but that's probably not something you will touch in this course. It's like global topological charges and so on and so forth. So I think that's all we want to say about this at the moment. Yes, that's as thorough as I'm going to be. If you have any questions related to it. Okay, then we will continue. Yes?
I should then be a pseudo scalar.
Yes. Exactly. Okay, so the next thing we want to do is that we want to take this and introduce it into the path integral formalism. So for now, we will deal only with the Young-Mills Lagrangian. So we will we won't add the Dirac and the scalar Lagrangian or anything like that. So we will basically look at pure couplings between, you know, gauge fields, so on and so forth. So we introduce that in, well, the expected manner, I guess. So this is then equal to, I'll do the Minkowski space version, where this S here is, the integral over the Young-Mills Lagrangian, as expected. And if we want to introduce a source term to do a generating functional, we do that in the expected way. So this is equal to mu a to the I SCM Mills, and then plus I times the integral over space times some source term mu A X A mu X, right? So you get one generator for every direction, every position, every group element. Okay. This here is the expected thing. So the total differential quantity or the integral constant is equal to, you know, the multiplication over all directions, all group elements, and all positions, dA mu A. Okay. Other than that, what's interesting to say? One thing that's actually, well, it's sort of expected, but you get the, okay, let's see. Just give me a sec. Yeah, okay, the number of A's you have, or all the different A's, are given by the number of generators needed to construct the group you're talking about. And this is sort of a fixed number for all the different symmetry groups, independent of representation. Makes sense, of course, because you know that A should transform independent of representation, so why wouldn't it? And for instance, then for SUN theories, this number is n squared minus 1. It's the number of different generators. And by that, since you know that QCD is basically the inclusion of SU3, coupled to fermions, that means that there are 8 gluons, right?
In the exponent, you have the scalar product of J and A.
Yes.
Has the mu also to be written
off? Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks. Let's see. Okay, so the next thing we want to do is to get the Feynman diagrams for this theory here. So basically, if we look at the Young-Mills action, then in the Young-Mills Lagrangian, Young-Mills, this is equal to minus, as I said, 1/4 times F A mu nu F nu A, right? And the Fs are equal to this term here. That basically means that if you square it, you will get a couple of terms that look like a derivative of field squared. Well, let's use this one because that's the one we're looking at. So you know, if you square this quantity, you will get a couple of things that's, you know, this part squared, which looks like a derivative squared. But you will also get cross terms between these quantities and these quantities. So you see that you get a cross term between this and these two, which basically gives you. So this thing is, okay, so this thing is equal to something that's like a derivative squared A squared, right? Something that looks like that. And then you have a term that looks like a coupling and a derivative of A times A squared, and you get something that looks like the coupling squared A fourth, right? And from a Feynman diagram perspective, then these squared terms, as you know before, it's basically every term in the Lagrangian that comes up with a field squared contribute to the propagator. And then all the others are then interactions or self-interactions from the field. So you get, you know, the propagator, that's fine. We will talk about what this is in a moment. And then you get things that are like three-point self-interactions. And you get things that are four-point self-interactions, right? Ooh. Let's not go there. Okay. And this is basically, this is one of the important the reasons why non-abelian gauge theory is, because, of course, the self-interaction only comes about if it has these structure constants. And they are zero for every abelian gauge theory. And this is the reason why non-abelian gauge theories are, so first of all, so much more difficult to work with than abelian gauge theories, because you get all of these self-interactions. So if you want to do something like, you know, scattering, or simple scattering, then you can have all kind of weird effects where you can basically create. There are lots of weird diagrams. I can't think of one at the top of my head. Okay, you know, something that it basically interacts with itself throughout, which makes this quite complicated, and it's one of the rings or the reasons why you have this gluon. You've probably heard about it. You know, the gluon string potential. The idea behind it is basically if you take two point charges and you exchange gluons in between these two point charges, and they can, you know, take all possible, you know, paths between the two. Since they self-interact, this thing sort of tightens into what you call sort of the gluon string potential. So anyway, from this we get this, which we say is, you know, proportional to G, and this thing here is proportional to G squared somehow. So if we take G to be, you know, a small coupling constant, and if you do perturbation theory, this will then be the coupling you expand around, so that, you know, two of these give the same order of contribution as one of these, and so on and so forth. Okay. First of all, does anyone know what the time is?
12.
Oh, okay. We have some time left on. The lecture will probably be a bit shorter than normal. It sort of depends. Okay, so when we want to study the propagator of these gluon fields, we basically take the free part of the Young-Mills Lagrangian. So we are interested in Young-Mills, and then let's call it free, something like that. This is, first of all, for electrons, this is, of course, or for QED, this is, of course, equal to the same as the normal Young-Mills. But this is equal to d mu A mu A d mu A mu A then d mu mu A minus d A. Right? Okay. So we can do a quick partial integration of this expression here. And, you know, the standard thing, you ignore the flux at the boundaries and all of that. You get T4x plus A mu A T squared G mu plus T. You get this expression here. And first of all, okay, we haven't really talked about this, but the fields A, they are bosonic fields, right? Or they are bosonic fields. So when you do the integration over Z, you get the inverse of whatever matrix is between the two fields, as usual. So from this thing here, is basically the inverse propagator. Of our field, as per usual. So there is actually a problem with this quantity, and that is that it's singular. So what that means is that basically the determinant of this quantity here this is equal to zero. And other than that, you could say that so the propagator, it can also be defined through the propagator equation. So basically you want to be able to find the propagator for the theory, you calculate mu d mu. Okay, yeah, it's just of course you can say that this is equal to B and then just add on delta AB in here if you want to make the propagator also you know, depend on the group indices. And then, you know, the propagator value T D. Okay. I've done something wrong here. No, I haven't. New row B C from X to Y. This thing should be equal to I times D mu rho D A C before. Let's see, it's a bit high. Okay. So this is the propagator equation, and this is basically what you use to find the propagator here. And this equation has no solution. So that's basically the same argument.
Mm-hmm. Would it be possible to introduce a divergence three term so that the terminal of this new inverse propagator would not vanish?
Yes, that's basically what we're going to do. Or not, I'm going to do. I'm going to motivate it, and then Mark will take over. What you're talking about is basically a gauge fixing term. So what you want to introduce into this Lagrangian is that you want to introduce a term that basically forces the gauge fields A to take a certain value. Okay. Another. Or the reason why this is actually so problematic is that, okay, wait a minute. Okay, so the reason why this is problematic is that we have seen earlier that A mu A basically transformed to A mu A plus 1 over G D mu A phi A. C C, right? So we know that A transform in this way. And the problem we're basically having is that since we, when we calculate the partition function, we integrate over all possible values that A can have in any direction and with any indices. And that means that because you can always transform the gauge field in this way, you are bound, when you integrate over all possible configurations, to get an infinite number of configurations where this is zero. And because you can get that, that basically means that this thing is just zero, which means that when you integrate over all of those possible configurations in Z, you will get, you know, an integral that basically looks like of d a problematic times 1. And that thing is, you know, badly divergent. It's not only, it's basically that. So we want to fix this. The problem basically arises from, since A is invariant under all of these gauge transformations, that means that all of the transformations you can do on A are physically equivalent. So you basically sum up over sort of an infinite number of the same physical system when you calculate a partition function, and that's a problem. So what we want to do is we want to fix the gauge of A. So sort of from a diagram speaking, if you look at, you know, A's and A's in some sort of weird infinite dimensional vector space, and you define these paths here, because we're supposed to integrate over all A's, right? So you find these paths here that are basically said that, okay, so they are connected by a gauge transformation. So if you have A here and A bar here, then basically they are connected by this gauge transformation that we talked about. So what we want to do is that we want to basically fix the gauge, and fixing the gauge basically means that we introduce some sort of surface in this hyperspace, call this surface, I don't know, omega or whatever, so that we can only pick out one element on this surface from every possible gauge transformation. Okay, so we do this by introducing what you call the gauge fixing function. So we basically introduce some function f of A of mu that is required to be equal to zero. And if we introduce this somehow into our Lagrangian, we basically fix a specific hypersurface in a space, which is where we basically let A vary. Just as I will probably end very soon-ish, I guess. But sort of just as what we will find later, if you need this expression, one possible propagator in P space, P squared, so this will, after gauge fixing, will be one of the possible propagators you can find. So what you will see from all of the propagators you find after gauge fixing is that they normally, they will always depend on the gauge fixing scheme you've chosen. So for instance, here we have created, or using some sort of gauge fixing, I'm going to guess that Mark will do this shortly. We have basically created a full set of propagators that all depend on this parameter psi that we have introduced. So this is just one of the possible parameters to say something about this function here. And you will see that propagators will always depend on the gauge you choose. But what's important, of course, is that when you're done with all and you've calculated actual physical quantities, then these parameters will always drop out in the end. Because the final result cannot depend on the gauge you've chosen. And since we know that they are all physically the same, it shouldn't matter which gauge you choose. So, yeah.
What about the indices A and B in the propagation?
Ah. Okay. Sorry. Great. That is about what I wanted to cover today. Okay, so if you're interested, I can very quickly talk about an alternate way of finding F, but it's probably not that interesting. It basically actually comes, it does not directly come from Lattice QCD, but it's sort of motivated by it, because in Lattice QCD, I will talk about it anyway, very quickly though. In Lattice QCD, what you basically, or what the Young-Mills Lagrangian in Lattice QCD is the trace of what you call a gauge plaquette. So a gauge plaquette is basically you start at a position and then you gauge transform into the neighboring position. And okay, so gauge transforming between one and two positions, that basically comes from the Lattice formulation that gauge elements live on sort of the links of the lattices. So applying a gauge link moves the field you're looking at from one sort of lattice position to another lattice position. And basically, if you go around in a loop like this, in a closed loop, and take the trace of that, you get something that is gauge invariant. So if you take the lattice formulation and then send the distance between the points here, A, to zero, then you basically return this Young-Mills Lagrangian. But there is also sort of a non-lattice way of doing exactly the same argument, and that is by introducing some sort of quantity that relates to positions. And the important thing about this quantity is that when you transform it, it does not transform sort of locally anymore, but it transforms like WYXUX. And you want this to be 1 at x equals to y. And you also want this to be unitary. And if you then expand this in the generators of the group you're interested in, and basically multiply 4 of them together and expand out the results of how they transform, you will end up with the field strength tensor. So basically, if you put 4 of them together so that they make a loop, and then you make the loop infinitely small, you will also get back to this field strength tensor. It's a local operator. So that's another way of getting F. I've always preferred using the derivatives just because it's easier, but that's about it. So yeah, I think that's all. Thank you.
Is there any Excel sheet?
Yes, I have it here.